a voice is calling, bells of memory chime. Come home again, they call through the oceans of time. We'll keep a welcome in the hillsides, we'll keep a welcome in the vales. This land you knew will still be singing when you come home again. This land a song will keep a welcome, and with a love that never fails, we'll kiss away each hour of here life when you come home again to Wales. We'll kiss away.
I'll bet that woke you up. That was Harry Seacombe with We'll Keep a Welcome in the Hillside. Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 129. Now, as our friend and podcast listener Chris Mounts has reminded me, it's St. David's Day on the 1st of March. Therefore, I thought I would honour my partial ancestry and do a podcast where the two main actors in the two movies of which I was speaking are Welsh. In this case, the actors are Stanley Baker and Richard Burton, and the movies are Robbery from 1967 and The Night of the Iguana from 1964. So sit back, relax, and we'll get on with some Welsh podcasting. Yucky da, and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast. Paleo Cinema Podcast is a podcast of old movie appreciation. There are only two rules. The first one is the movie has to be at least 20 years old. And the second one is I have to like it or at least appreciate it in some way. Feedback's really, really important to us, so we'd love to get some here. And the contact details are you can email feedback, a voicemail if you like, to kultguru@gmail.com, kultguru@gmail.com. The voicemail number in the United States is 206-337-5398, so you can use that as well. Or you can put a comment through on the Paleo Cinema Cafe on the Book of Faces. This podcast may contain adult concepts and swearing. So if you're not into that sort of thing, it may not be for you, but I do hope you stick around and listen to this show anyway. Take care and enjoy Paleo Cinema. How is everybody? We're doing okay here. The weather's starting to turn a little bit cooler from the summer heat. We'll probably get another burst of summer and then it'll really start cooling down a bit. But things at the moment, I've got a long sleeve shirt on, which shows you that summer isn't quite over, but it's on its way out. No, I haven't been watching the Sochi Olympics because A, I don't want to encourage Putin's homophobia, and B, sport bores the fuck out of me. Haven't been doing too much. I was just kind of low-keying it around here a bit. Visited a few friends, hung out for a while, watched a few movies, and that kind of thing. So, yeah, it's very kind of low-key at the moment. Now, what have I been watching lately? Let me have a look through my Letterboxd, which you can find if you search in Letterboxd without the E at the end, under Paleo Cinema without the dash in the middle. You'll find what I've been watching. So let's have a look here. I've actually realised I've just missed one of the movies I've watched, but that's okay. Let's see. I watched Escape Plan with Sylvester Stallone and Arnold Schwarzenegger. And of the two, Schwarzenegger turns out to be the better actor in that film, which is really unusual. It's there are bits of it that hark back to 1980s adventure films, as you'd expect with a movie that stars both Schwarzenegger and Stallone, neither of whom speaks the English language particularly well. But yeah, it's not a bad little action thriller. It kind of works on its own level, but it's not deeper than it needs to be. So it's a half a recommendation, let's say that. The other thing one of the other things I've seen is a movie called Closed Circuit, starring Eric Bana. It's a kind of political thriller set in London around terrorism and the legalities involved in the British laws regarding terrorism. It's a nice little thriller and very much real politic. Some good acting in it. Jim Broadbent is particularly good in a villainous role. And it does really work. Not one of those over-the-top fantastic movies, but low-key and suspenseful, and it does have a few things to say about Western societies and their approach to the problems of terrorism. I did see another Stanley Baker movie as well over the last fortnight, a movie called The Man Who Finally Died, which is kind of cool. It's about a guy who emigrated to England from Germany before the war when he was a child, and goes back to Germany because his father has died, and so he goes back to kind of bury his father and find out about things, and gets involved in some spy intrigue. It's got Peter Cushing in it, Mae Zettling's in it, Eric Portman's in it, also Niall McGuinness, who I've always liked since I first saw him in Night of the Demon, is in it as well. It's black and white, filmed in Germany, which makes it slightly different. And, an okay kind of second programmer thriller. Not one of the better known Stanley Baker movies, but he does an honest hand at playing the character and doing the job well. What else have I watched? I watched an Italian crime movie called Milano Calibro 9, which stars one of my new favourite actors. It's a Fernando De Leo movie. So it's one of my new favourite actors, being Mario Adolf, who I first saw in The Italian Connection with Woody Strode and Henry Silva. This one isn't quite as good, but yeah, it's a nice little thriller in some ways. This one's got Barbara Boucher as well, which is kind of interesting in a visual sense. But it's a good, honest little crime picture, but not quite at the standards of the previous one I saw. I've got a couple of other recommendations given to me for Italian crime movies of the 70s, which I'm going to have to acquire and watch. But yeah, there was good enough to keep me going in that particular genre. I did see a 1960s American comedy called A Guide for a Married Man with Walter Matthau and Robert Morse. It's kind of one of those kind of slightly saucy sex comedies that America did before they got bold and decided to really embrace sexuality. It's a movie about going and fucking women behind your wife's back, which has little vignettes by a whole bunch of famous comedians and actors and things like that. But politically correct, it's not. Is it particularly funny? Not particularly funny. And it does have a really unusual fetish for female bums, which is not in itself a bad thing. I mean, I'm as much an aficionado of those things as other people are. But it's a really odd the way the movie focuses on that and uses that as the main sexual stimulant for the male characters in the film, which, you know, isn't my experience of sexuality, but it does have a lot of famous people in it. But I think it's one of those movies that the tide of human events has left it high and dry and rusting on the beach. So, yep, I can't particularly recommend that one, though. It's really odd that it does have a theme song sung by the Turtles. I've gone back to Europe again. I've seen a couple of Commissar X movies, which are kind of low-rent, James Bondian, Eurospy flicks, which are a little bit of fun. I saw Kiss Kiss Kill Kill and Three Golden... I'm trying to translate from the German here. Give me a moment and I'll just hover over this so I can see what it says. Three Golden Serpents from 1967, which, they're both kind of interesting. They star Tony Kendall and Brad Harris and a whole bunch of German people. And the only good thing about them, really, apart from the fact that they're James Bond pastiches, and I'm very fond of James Bond pastiches, is they're set in interesting settings. One of them is set in Thailand in the 1960s, which is kind of cool. And the other one, I don't remember well enough to say where it was set. but the Combat RX movies are really an acquired taste, which I kind of like. It's a popcorn movie. It's one of those ones you grab a handful and just devour it without particularly caring what you watch. So I watched a couple of those. The only other thing is Guilty Pleasure. I saw Step Brothers again with Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly, which I recommend because it's a very funny comedy and it's always a lot of fun, and I've got it on Blu-ray and I watch it every now and then. The other thing I should mention too, and this is a bit of a squee for me, is the Guardians of the Galaxy trailer came out, the new Marvel film, and this is more a Martian Drive-In podcast kind of movie than a Paleo Cinema one, but the trailer came out for Guardians of the Galaxy, and it kicks ass. If you haven't seen it, check it out. Really, really good. I put up a Facebook message saying, James Gunn, the director, you've really done the right thing with this, and it looks fantastic. And I got a like from the director of this film. So I went into total squee mode then, and really kind of liked the way James Gunn, as a human being and as a part of Hollywood now, and very much an up-and-coming director, embraces social media and does kind of recognize his fan base. So that was kind of cool. But anyway, that's about all I've really watched. Watched a little bit of television, mostly political stuff here in Australia, because things are getting very dark and dystopian here in my homeland. And if you follow me on Facebook or friend me up on Facebook, you're not going to make the mistake of thinking that's not the case. We are treating asylum seekers abysmally badly and putting them in essentially what are concentration camps in Papua New Guinea. There are a lot of people upset about it. We're doing things about it. There are protests being raised. But we've got a government that ignores the right thing to do because they're following after popularity. And like pretty much most countries, there is a certain number of the, a certain percentage of the population that's incredibly xenophobic and who thinks it's okay to put refugees who are fleeing the possibility of death into dangerous conditions. There was a riot and an escape from the Manus Island Detention Centre in Papua New Guinea last week, and one of the people died who was killed by basically a goon squad of the Papua New Guinean police. We have to do better, and I can only hope that we will, because I don't want my country to be the bad guys. It's really as simple as that. And that's kind of taken up a lot of my thoughts lately. Are we heading in the right direction as a nation? Is what we're doing going to be looked at by the future as a positive thing or a negative thing? If it's seen as a positive thing, then I despair for the future of the human race. But having said that in a very melancholy tone, it's time to talk about the two films, and I'll start off chronologically, which is the way I do things, with 1960... Actually, I'll do it in reverse chronological order because I want to end on the high note of the second film. I'm going to talk about Robbery from 1967, starring Stanley Baker, which is based on the Great Train Robbery from 1963. I'll just play a little bit of a grab from it at the start. This is the bit where Stanley Baker lays out the plans for the guys. Now, there's a lot of noise in the background deliberately because the guys are standing in a car park near an airport, so they can't be overheard. And so if there are many mics or bugs around, I was going to say bikes and mugs, but it's mics and bugs around, they can't be overheard. So totally professional and totally hard-ass Stanley Baker.
Here's how it is, then. We've got the capital now for the investment. Agree to go ahead?
Yep.
Well, why don't we share out in the usual way? I mean, we're doing all right.
I want us to do better, Frank.
I don't know.
There's one thing I know. Money breeds money.
Mine must be on the pill.
All right, Frank, I'll pay you off. I'll find another firm that's interested. In £3 or £4 million.
£4 million? Count me in.
The job, Paul. It's a night mail train from Glasgow to London. The Tuesday after the holiday.
What? Not till after the holiday?
Exactly. The The banks will have been closed from midday Saturday till Tuesday morning. There'll be that much more money on the train.
What happens to the money afterwards?
A friend of ours flies it out of the country within the hour.
Ah! Where do we share out?
Switzerland? Shares delivered wherever you like.
I know where I want mine delivered.
Okay. There's just one more thing. This is the big one, the biggest. From now until we finish the job, I want no trouble with the law. You understand, Jack?
Me? I'll be as good as gold.
We've got nothing to worry about then, have we?
Okay, so this is a 1967 movie starring and produced by Stanley Baker. It stars him, Joanna Pettit, James Booth, Frank Finlay, Barry Foster, George Sewell, Glenn Edwards, and a bunch of other really rough-looking faces. The only thing you need to know about the film from the plot point of view is that it's a dramatization of the 1963 Great Train Robbery that Ronnie Biggs and Buster Edwards and those guys were involved with. So that was an enormous robbery in England. They stole 2 tons of money from a train going between Glasgow and London, and got away with it for a while. There were some people involved that were never caught as well, which is kind of interesting. But, this movie really does kick ass. It was directed by Peter Yates, and this is a movie that Steve McQueen saw before he made Bullet. And it was Steve McQueen's choice after seeing this film, which didn't get a particularly wide release in England, to get Peter Yates to direct Bullet. So, and the reason is the first 10 minutes of the film, really, because there's a robbery that occurs in the first 10 minutes of this film, which is kind of unrelated to the Great Train Robbery, except that some of the same guys are involved in it, which is beautifully filmed and has an enormous car chase between a Mercedes and some police cars through the streets of London. It really does, it's almost like an introduction to Peter Yates as a director. There's a lot of point of view shots filmed within the cars. There's a lot of shots from high on buildings as the cars race through the streets. And it really does kick ass. It's tense. It's incredibly well edited. The camera angles are particularly well chosen. And it does end on a very tense scene at a school crossing where kids are being crossed by a lollipop person crossing the street as the car chase is coming towards them. It's got a particular resonance for me because my father-in-law is a lollipop man. But, and that sets things up really well. And Stanley Baker's not in any of that. These are the other guys that are working with him who do this robbery and who get away with that particular robbery quite well, except for one little kind of coda at the end of it. The beautiful thing about this film is the location choices. As they're planning the robbery, they meet in unusual locations, like at a football match. Not a big football match, but one of the kind of regional football matches. The guys all stand together watching the football matches if they don't know each other and talk without using their eyes to look at each other about the robbery and how it's going and how the planning is going. And they find they need a whole bunch of different things. They need a train driver. They need somebody who can identify which of the bills are useful and which ones are going to be easily identified. They need some good drivers. They need some good hard men. It's basically meticulously planned. Now, everything in the film is speculation about the planning of it, including the things like their hideout is an air raid shelter on a disused RAF base, in the UK. So their whole hideout is underground and hidden from view. Even if you walk through the RAF base, you won't find the entrance to it because of the way things are set up. So they've got that down really well. That's filmed on a really nice location, 22 years after the war ended. Showing the kind of run-down nature of the old RAF bases that they had during the war. So you've got that. You've got a cast who really put it across, particularly people like George Sewell, who people might remember was in Gerry Anderson's TV UFO. Really good playing a hard crim because he's a big beefy guy and he's got pock marks on his face and doesn't take shit. And then you've got Stanley Baker, who is great at playing a hard man. He's got that kind of ruggedness about him. He's a total professional as a criminal. He's smart. He's got a certain vulnerability. There are a couple of scenes with his wife which kind of show a certain level of vulnerability that he has up to a certain point. But the scenes between him and Joanna Pettit playing his wife, Vanessa Redgrave was originally going to play the wife, but she dropped out of the film before production started. They're kind of superfluous in a sense. This is not a woman's movie in any way. But the scenes, if you lost the scenes between his character Paul and his wife, played by Joanna Pettit, the movie wouldn't lack it, because this is purely an action film. It's one of those movies where it's all about what goes on. Now, I said that most of it's speculation about the robbery, but the robbery itself is taken from the court transcripts, which were publicly available when a whole bunch of the great train robbers went on trial. So the robbery itself is accurate as much as they humanly can make it, and it is quite exciting too. There are these weird little facts too, like they had to leave a quarter of a ton of the money behind because they just couldn't carry it and they couldn't get it out in time. They had a strict time limit for robbing the train before, you know, the balloon went up about it. And they left behind something like £110,000 worth of money because they just couldn't carry any more in the time that they'd allocated themselves to do the job. And that's actual fact. That's actually what happened during the robbery, which is kind of interesting. Robbing a money train and then not being able to carry all the money away shows that you really are being very successful. Now, They got away with about £3 million worth, which doesn't sound like an enormous amount these days. But you'd have to kind of add a factor of 10 to it. So it's the equivalent of robbing a £30 or £40 million worth of money in current value, because you know, wages were a lot less then, things cost a lot less then, so the money had a lot more value to it. And this movie is a solid British crime flick. There's a continuum of good British crime movies which probably go from something like Brighton Rock in the 1940s all the way through to The Long Good Friday and a few contemporary movies like Layer Cake and things like that, and one or two of the Guy Ritchie films he did before he became Madonna's husband. But this one's stock dead in the middle of those, and it's gritty. It's tough. It's based on a true story within certain parameters, because we don't really know what happened to the money and the people who escaped, where they went to and who they were, and all of those details. But it's a solid crime flick. And you've got the usual things too. Frank Finlay plays the guy that they get out of. They actually get him out of prison so he can separate out the money that's going to be identifiable from the money that's not, and the money that's good from the money that's bad. And his character has a couple of flaws, which in normal life, in normal circumstances, would be virtues. But in the world of this crime and this robbery, his dedication to his family is a weakness, which does fuck things up for the crims. Now, this wasn't a victimless crime at all. The money was owned by banks, and banks have got insurance and things like that. So in that sense, there's not really a victim. But in real life, the train driver and suffered severe injuries during the robbery and wasn't able to work ever again. So it's not a victimless crime. And it is a crime of violence, but leaving that aside, the film is tough. It's logically paced. It's got good acting in it, particularly Stanley Baker, who doesn't overplay as opposed to Richard Burton in Night of the Iguana that I'm going to talk about in a little bit. He doesn't overplay the role. He's quiet. He doesn't draw attention to himself. He's got a big Northern England moustache and a flat cap on his head. He doesn't dress fancy. He's a consummate professional, and he kind of earns your respect as a viewer for being that kind of a person. He's tough, but he's not maliciously cruel. He's trying to keep control of all of these wide range of crims, and he puts across that kind of person very well. Now, one of the reasons why British actors play crims so well, particularly in the 40s, 50s and 60s, is purely the fact that they hung around with them. Now, you've got to consider this. British crims hung around in members' clubs, nightclubs basically around London, and particularly around Soho and places like that, because that was the only place you could get a drink after the pubs closed. You had to be a member of a club, then you could be served drinks in the club. So all these little nightclubs and kind of upstart cafes started up around London in the 50s and 60s to cater to the late night trade. Actors who were acting in any one of the theatres in the theatre district of London finished work at about 11 and then headed off for a few drinks with their mates, and they could sleep in the next day and do that. So inevitably, a lot of the actors working in the London theatre, and also occasionally in movies and television, were naturally at the same place at the same time as a lot of the crims who were hanging around London, like the Cray brothers and people like that. So there was a lot of talk about people like Stanley Baker and a bunch of other actors being involved with criminals and being friends with criminals. It just turns out they were drinking at the same place. And they obviously there was a bit of overlap, and particularly the Cray brothers were not adverse to making friends with actors because, you know, they were celebrities, and you obviously wanted to show what a big crim you were by being mates with a few actors. You know, people like Ollie Reed were there. If you've seen Jeffrey Bernard Is Unwell, he talks about a bunch of character actors who hung around these late night clubs with the crims and inevitably learned how to appear like a criminal from that proximity and from watching what real crims do. And Stanley Baker and a bunch of the other actors, George Sewell and Barry Foster, who was in Frenzy for Hitchcock as well, picked up on that and played it like genuine crims because they knew what those crims were like and where they were hanging out. Now, in this movie, you've also got to give kudos to Johnny Keating's score, particularly at the start of the film with the first car chase after the diamond robbery, and over the titles at the start of the film, which show the train going along the track. Johnny Keating does a really good score. Didn't do a hell of a lot of work after the 1960s as far as writing scores were concerned. He did some television work. He did some work for various television series and writing theme songs and things like that for it. But basically, he was a jazz musician. But his score in this film is top-notch stuff and really gets you into the mood for the movie from the word go. And a lot of these British soundtrack composers don't get a lot of love because they're not the really big names, but there are some good, honest journeyman composers out there that did good work in these movies, which didn't have enormously large budgets. This one probably was around £300,000, which wasn't a really large one at the time, but it made a fair bit of money in England. As I said, it had a limited release in America. I don't remember it being released here in Australia because they were a bit twitchy about doing how-tos for crimes, and some movies just didn't get a release because it was too hard to get them past the censors. They would have been cut to pieces, and things like Rafifi they didn't show in Australia for a lot of years for that reason. But it's not really a how-to because people would know how-to from reading the news footage about the great train robberies, so they weren't actually adding to the basic criminal knowledge that's out in the public at all. But it's, I kind of like films like this. They're not the big showy ones that a lot of other people know about, but they're good, solid entertainments. They've got good actors doing interesting things in interesting locations. And since this one was made in 1967, they've become historical documents as well. They show London the way it was in 1967. And I kind of like that for any city. I prefer if it's just a city I know, and I know London a little bit from having been there. But in general, I like that aspect of location shooting where it does capture in the background a snapshot of the time and place, what people were wearing, how they looked, what they were doing, what buildings were there, what advertising were in the buildings, what cars they drove. All those kinds of things really add an extra layer for us looking at them historically. People at the time would have just accepted the fact that that was London. But for us, there are so many other things that catch our eyes in movies set in the past and filmed in the past. Sorry, not set in the past, but filmed in the past, that it really does add things. Things like Carry On movies and Ealing films have a lot of that too, where you can see how London used to be. The Lady Killers, for instance, there's a lot of location shooting in there where you do see late 1950s London, which is kind of interesting. And there are still bombed out lots where they haven't rebuilt yet. They haven't had money or time to rebuild after the World War II, even though it was 10 or 15 years later. All of those kind of details and layers to a city, particularly in a crime movie, add to it enormously. So there's not too much else to say about Robert except see it if you haven't. The copy I had wasn't quite widescreen, so I'm going to have to locate a legit copy, but it is around the place. I'm sure it has come out on DVD. But highly recommended because it's dead solid, and I always like Stanley Baker in movies. And Stanley Baker was one, if you remember from the early days of Paleo Cinema, if you go back that far, when I did the alternative Magnificent Seven, Stanley Baker was one of the actors I put into my alternative Magnificent Seven. And just to refresh your memory, I'm going to bring up my alternative Magnificent Seven, which is Burt Lancaster, Woody Strode, Jean-Paul Belmondo, Lee Marvin, Richard Boone, Rod Taylor, and Stanley Baker. They're my alternative Magnificent Seven. So Stanley Baker definitely a part of that. What I'm going to do at some stage, and I'll get around to it, is a Magnificent Seven of Australian tough guy actors. And I'm working on that, and I'm still sketching things on bits of paper. So I'm going to do that at some stage in the future and add it to the podcast as well. So I'm going to take a break now. When we get back, we're going to talk about an even more interesting film, which kind of I'd never seen in its entirety. I've seen bits and pieces of it channel surfing, but I'd never seen it in its entirety. And that's 1964's The Night of the Iguana, starring Richard Burton, Ava Gardner, Deborah Carr, Sue Lyon, and Grayson Hall, directed by John Huston. Life as a game.
London King. Then he's only born to lose. Born to lose. Born to lose. Born to lose. Born to lose.
That was Jackie Lee with Born to Lose, which was the theme to the movie Robbery.
Hey, all you podcast listeners, here's an update.
See? Here.
We know some of that bad brown acid has been going around, but we've got an alternative.
See? Here.
Have these headphones here. Throw them on. See here. Movies for your mind.
See here.
See here podcast. We discuss music-related films once a month. Find us on iTunes or at seehear, that's S-E-E-H-E-A-R, .podbean.com.
Just relax, listen, and float downstream.
See here.
Little bit of Iron Butterflies in a Garden of Eden there in the See Here podcast promo. So on to Night of the Iguana, starring Richard Burton, who is a distant relative of mine. This one's based, of course, on the play by Tennessee Williams, a play which I've never seen live. And as I said earlier, I've only ever seen the movie in little bits and pieces, not in its entirety. And seeing it in its entirety, I thought, yes, this is definitely one to do for Paleo Cinema Podcast, because it isn't the sort of movie that I thought it would be. Now, I'm going to play you an extended clip from right at the start of the movie showing the character T. Lawrence Shannon, played by Richard Burton, going bugfuck crazy in a church, because one of the things that are always good in movies is people going bugfuck crazy in churches. Now, to set up the context for this one, he has recently had an assignation with a young woman who's involved with the church. Now, whether she's underage or not, it's not really explicitly stated, but she is younger than he is. And this is him doing his sermon after the shit hits the fan.
Let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be always acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, my strength and my redeemer. The sermon for today is taken from Proverbs, chapter 25, verse 28. He that hath no rule over his own spirit is like a city that is broken down and without walls. And I wonder, as we examine our hearts together in this place set aside for worship, how many of us here can say, I rule my own spirit? For how weak is man? How often do we stray from the straight and narrow? For only when we abide in the Lord are we like cities without walls. Only then can we defend ourselves against Satan and his temptations. We cannot rule ourselves alone. God only is our help and our salvation. All right. You know. That's why you're here. To see this city with its broken walls. Whenever two or three are gathered together in my name is what the scripture says. But that's not why you're here. Let's change the words. Let's rewrite the order of the morning prayer. Whenever two or three or 20 or 30 or 200 or 300 are gathered together to make whispered comment, to sit in judgment upon the condition of a what? Yes, of a man of God. I said man of God, and I mean it. Just what you all know, that your pastor, your spiritual shepherd, is the descendant of a clergyman, the grandson of two bishops. But there were collateral branches to the family that went forth to brave dangers and who were scalped. Men with men's hearts, the wild and free hearts of men. They knew hunger and they fed their appetites. They fed their appetites, appetites that I have inherited. I defy you. Shannon defies you. Get out your tomahawks. Get out your scalping knives. scout me. I will not and cannot continue to conduct services in praise and worship of this angry, petulant old man in whom you believe. You turn your backs on the God of love and compassion and invented for yourself this cruel, senile delinquent who blames the world and all that he created for his own faults.
So 1964, that must have been a confronting start to a movie, and I was sure that it pissed off a whole bunch of conservative and religious people. But ultimately, it sets up the character of T. Lawrence Shannon quite well. He's had a breakdown, as you can understand, and we next see him as he's leading a guided tour of Baptist ladies through rural Mexico on a bus. I'll just give you a bit of a précis from IMDb before I get further into this, just to give you a bit of a context for it. The IMDb says this: a defrocked Episcopal clergyman leads a busload of middle-aged Baptist women on a tour of Mexican coast and comes to terms with the failure haunting his life, which is kind of minimal. Here's a better one. The Reverend T. Lawrence Shannon has been living in Mexico for 2 years, working as a tourist guide for a cut-rate travel agency. Shannon lost his church and was defrocked after taking liberties with one of the parishioners. He is now accompanying a group of middle-aged ladies from Texas whose leader, Judith Fellows, is keeping a close eye on her teenage ward, Charlotte Goodall, who definitely has an interest in the former priest. After Charlotte and Shannon spend the night together, platonically as it happens, Fellows is out having fight, and to keep her from communicating with his employer, Shannon strands them at a remote hotel run by his good friend Maxine Falk, played by Ava Gardner. It's the arrival of Hannah Jilks, and her, who was played by Deborah Carr, and her elderly grandfather that has the greatest impact, however. Her approach to life and love forces Shannon to deal with these demons and to re-evaluate his life. That's quite a good précis, and I'm quite pleased with that. Gary KMCD, you did well with that one. Okay, so this is basically, it's a Tennessee Williams story, which means it's always going to have over-the-top characters and kind of hidden depths to it and things like that. But the most interesting thing about the film of all is that it started a tourist boom which still continues in Jalisco in Mexico, because at the time this film was made in about 63, it was released in 64, there was a tiny little fishing village called Puerto Vallarta, I mispronounced that, which after the movie came out, people thought, geez, that's good looking, let's go down there and visit it. And it became this enormous tourist destination that it is now. And it's full of apartment buildings and hotels and swimming pools and all sorts of shit. But in the movie, as you see, it's quite a sleepy little place and not really on the tourist trail. John Huston bought a house for $30,000 just outside the town because he liked the place so much. And in fact, there is a statue of him in the area, recognizing the fact that his choice of location for the film is what started the tourist boom in the area. Of course, there are a lot of other things. There were some government policies that helped the tourist industry as well, which kind of kick-started it, and a few other bits and pieces. But essentially, this movie created a city, which is not something that movies traditionally do. They tend to destroy them. But this one definitely did. So you've got the characters around whom this plot line revolves. You've got Shannon, the defrocked priest, who's an alcoholic and who's trying to dry out because he's got his last chance with this cheap and nasty tourist agency that he works for. You've got Maxine, played by Ava Gardner, very earthy and bawdy and sexy, who runs a hotel. Her husband died a couple of months before, and he ran the hotel with her. So she's, his name was Fred. She's kind of known to have assignations with the two beach boys that she has helping her run the hotel, who don't never say a word. They communicate by maracas. They just rattle maracas around as every form of communication that they have, which is really kind of unusual. But they're kind of shirtless muscle boys who Maxine has helping her run the hotel, and of course, pour midnight assignations down at the beach. Then you've got Hannah Jilks, who's an artist who does sketches of people for a living, who travels around the world with her grandfather, a 95-year-old poet, who is becoming increasingly infirmed and who has to get one last poem out of himself before he'll permit himself to die. Now, this is a minor character, but he's very crucial to the plot line. The other main character is Judith Fellows, played by an actress called Grayson Hall, who, in the two movies I've seen her in, played lesbians, or at least people who were kind of lesbians. There's another movie called Satan in High Heels, where she played an overtly lesbian character around the same time this film was made. But in this one, she plays a character who's a very upright Baptist woman who doesn't know she's a lesbian. And that makes it quite interesting, because everybody else, particularly Maxine and Hannah Jilks and Shannon, know she is. The way she's protective and yet covetous of her ward, played by Sue Lyon from Lolita, it's pretty obvious that she has an attraction for her. The character Charlotte is the young girl who's very precocious. Now, the difficult thing about this film, there are a couple of difficulties with the film that I've had. And the first one is, Shannon can be seen from our viewpoint as a borderline pedophile. That makes it a little bit difficult. There is no evidence in the film, and I'm only going by the film, I'm not going by the stage play. There's no evidence in the film that the parishioner he slept with was underage. He said young. He didn't say underage when he was talking about her. Nothing indicates it. And the fact that he resists Charlotte's advances to him, and she is quite sexually precocious. Played by Sue Lyon when she was 17 years old, which kind of sets up that. There's a scene where Shannon and Charlotte walk out of the ocean, and he's wearing a pair of undies, and basically his junk's outlined in the undies, and she's wearing a very brief bikini, and it kind of, it's a little discomforting to see there, and it does take us into those treacherous waters where the character of Shannon is not believed, even though it's obvious from what we see in the film that he is not coming on to the girl is coming on to him, which takes us into those kind of treacherous waters where, oh, she was seducing me, that kind of thing which we hear in trials of people with basically pedophiles. But in this case, it's what's actually happening. Now, that is a dangerous place for a film from our 21st century viewpoint to be. But putting that aside, and we'll assume just for the sake of this, because there are some important issues that come up later as well, and I'm not trying to dismiss this as an important issue, but we'll assume that Shannon is as we see him in this film, and he's not actually a pedophile, but he's just somebody who, when temptation arises, has difficulty overcoming it, even though in the film he does overcome the temptation. So we'll acknowledge that kind of ambiguity there and move on from it. The character of Maxine's really great, and I think it's one of Ava Gardner's great kind of middle career roles. She's kind of sexy and earthy and forthright and not ladylike at all. She's kind of like Ava Gardner was in real life, sexually adventurous, prone to swearing, and quite attractive in a slightly vulnerable way. And I think that the role was originally played on the stage, by the way. I'll let you know what the roles were played by. Patrick O'Neill played Shannon in the original stage version. Bette Davis played Maxine in the original stage version, though after a while she was replaced by Shelley Winters. And the third character of Hannah Jilks was played by Margaret Leighton, the English actress. But I think the casting in this one is spot on. I think that Shannon is perfectly cast for Richard Burton. He's got those great speeches and those great vowels and the round theatrical way of speaking, which is in tune with a preacher. You've got Ava Gardner, I've mentioned, and Hannah Jelks, the spinsterish, inverted brackets, because spinsters aren't really a concept these days, and rightly so, artist, who Deborah Carr puts a lot of humanity into. She, in a sense, she's the human core of this whole thing. She's aware of her limitations. She's, like Shannon, suffers from depression, and they do have a conversation about how they manage the depression. Maxine herself is quite depressed at times and manages it with Beach Boys and other distractions. With Shannon, it's alcohol and the temptations of women, whether he actually fulfills those temptations or not. And for Hannah, she does things like deep breathing and thinking things through and manages it all. So the three main characters are depressed. Then we have the fourth character, Judith Fellows. Grayson Hall's an interesting actor too. She's kind of sharp featured, and in this one she plays a very, very nasty character. There's a moment of vulnerability she shows in one of the hotels they're staying overnight, which turns into rage once she realizes what's going on. But her character, because of the fact that she's basically a lesbian who never admits even to herself that she is, and therefore has these internal tensions and bitternesses and hostilities and suspicions, because she's not living her true nature and can't in the society she's in. Her brother's a lawyer and things like that, and she's got a certain social position where she lives, so she can't in that society admit that her preferences towards women. So that kind of tension sets up the nastiness and bossiness and rudeness and cruelty of the character really suspiciously. And eventually it gets to the stage where she's got Shannon sacked from his job, even though essentially in this circumstance he's innocent of any wrongdoing. And Shannon has just pissed on a suitcase, which is a funny scene. But there's a little bit that plays out here which kind of turns things around in a really interesting way and gives us an insight into Shannon's character and Maxine's character and Hannah's character as well.
Shannon, you've avenged yourself for all times on Miss Fellows' suitcase. I've heard of a dog cocking his leg. Why did you buzz off on your broomstick?
I'm not talking to you, I'm talking to him. I'm going to have you blacklisted in every travel agency in America.
What about Africa? Tasmania, Bechuanaland, Ton Mau?
Please, Miss Fellows, leave him alone.
As soon as I get back, I am going to swear out a warrant for your arrest. Molesting a minor, kidnapping, malicious damage to private property, indecent exposure.
What subject do you teach back in that college of yours, honey?
Boys, if that's got anything to do with it.
Well, geography's my specialty. Did you know that if it wasn't for the dikes, the plains of Texas would be engulfed by the Gulf?
Maxine.
Let's level for a while, butch old gal. You know what you're sore about, what you're really sore about? Is that little quail of yours has a natural preference for men instead of...
Maxine.
What is she talking about?
You better go now, Miss Fellows. The party's over. Right now, I'm no longer in a position to discharge my responsibility of protecting you. Responsibility from which you discharge me. Just go, Miss Fellows. Just go.
What'd you shut me up for? It's time somebody told that old dame off.
Miss Fellows is a highly moral person. If she ever recognized the truth about herself, it would destroy her.
Well, she's done a pretty good job of destroying you.
Maxine, don't rob me of the credit for my own small accomplishments.
In spite of the fact that she's just got him sacked from the only job he can hold and that he's just pissed on her suitcase, Shannon has this moment of kindness to Judith Fellows, which is the kind of redemption of the character, the fact that he confided in himself to be nice to somebody who's been incredibly nasty to him and to not reveal her secret to herself, which is kind of cool. Now, Shannon then goes, basically has a bit of a psychotic break and is tied up in a hammock at night time by Maxine and her boys so he won't run into the ocean and commit suicide. because which he has stated that he will do. So obviously he's having a great big depressive episode. Now, the Cabana Boys have tied up an iguana, which they're going to fatten up and eat, because apparently it's one of the local things to eat. And from what I know of it, they don't taste very good anyway. So there's Shannon at the end of his tether, and the iguana a couple of steps below the veranda where Shannon's tied up on the hammock, which is at the end of its rope as well. So there's a parallel there, which is interesting. And Maxine and Hannah Jelks tend to Shannon, and Hannah is left alone with Shannon, and they decide that they're going to talk openly and with no barriers to each other while he's coming down from this immense kind of manic depressive episode. And they talk about him, and they talk about Hannah's two sexual encounters, which aren't traditional sexual encounters. And the interesting thing is that the second one of which could be perceived as icky, but Hannah, the character, has made a choice not to do that. And she says a couple of things about human nature which are astonishingly profound and extremely wise. And you get the sense that the character, whatever happens, will abide. She too has a problem with depression at times and loneliness. She's traveling around the world with an increasingly infirmed grandfather, making a bare living sketching people in hotels. But Deborah Carr and Richard Burton have a tremendous rapport in those scenes, and they each have long monologues which are slightly theatrical in nature but are extremely deep and surprisingly touching. I wasn't expecting this movie to be touching. Now, as I may have stated in the podcast before, I'm a sucker for redemption stories, and this is definitely one of those. Now, I'm not going to reveal the ending. I'm not going to reveal what Hannah says. I'm not going to reveal anything of what Shannon says apart from that. But it's a very humane movie, even though there's the weirdnesses of the closet, you know, the in-denial lesbian woman, the alcoholic, is he or isn't he a pedophile guy, the sexually precocious teenage girl, Maxine with her Beach Boys, all that kind of stuff. In spite of that, it comes across as an incredibly humane movie. And I, as I said, I wasn't really expecting that. I'm not sure what I was expecting seeing the film, but it came up on my playlist on Foxtel, so I thought I'd watch it. And yeah, it's a bit of a favourite now, because I think it's very, very well made. It's in black and white widescreen, and it would have done well to be in colour, but of course it was at that stage where filming in colour is just that bit more expensive, and the fees for the three main actors took up half of the budget of the film, so there were obviously limitations there, remote location shooting being one of them. There was a big scandal because Richard Burton took Elizabeth Taylor down to the location shooting when they weren't married yet, and that kind of thing, so there was an immense media presence there, and things got a bit crazy with that. So in spite of all that, the movie is wise in a sense, and it does have things to say about human nature, and it's unusual for that. I think it's a movie that plays well because we're in a more accepting time. We can accept the fact that Maxine, even when she was, her husband Fred was alive, Fred kind of turned a blind eye to her dalliances with the Cabana Boys because they had that arrangement. That's a very 21st century kind of arrangement, but back then it would have been shocking. And we can accept Hannah's choice to be celibate, but to not let it turn her into a bitter person, but in a sense to empower her to be a better person and a more understanding person. And we can understand Shannon's acts of kindness, which are the redemption of the character in a way. So there's not too much else to say about this film without giving away way too much. But I really enjoyed Night of the Iguana. I think it's It's a good movie. It's not perfect. And again, I've got that ambiguity about the Shannon character, but I can only kind of address the character based on what I see in the film. And I think that, yeah, it works. It really does work. And usually I find Tennessee Williams stuff to be a little bit too strident. But in this case, the stridency of various characters is right for what who they are and the function that they perform in the movie. So I'm going to take another break now, and then there's some feedback.
I studied Shakespeare when I was at school. Thought Romeo was a pet. Felt if I met him, I'd act like a fool. I'd be a poor Juliet. Now that I know him, I'm not really sure. For you're as charming as he. Saying the same things to all the girls, or is it just to me? Shakespeare when I was at school, thought Romeo was a joy. I like the true way he loved Juliet, just my ideal of a boy. You know I like you as my Romeo, that's how I want you to be. But if you're out on some other date, can you be true to me?
Was Petula Clark with Romeo. And on to the feedback. The first bit of feedback I got was a Facebook message from our old and good friend Morris from Love That Album podcast. Here's what he says. Hey Terry, just started listening to Paleo Cinema 128 this morning. Looking forward to hearing you talk about Newsfront. I picked up a copy from JB for $7 the other week. A classic Australian film. I'd be interested in hearing you talking about The Master. I'm not taken with it at all. Performances were brilliant, but it dragged and I lost sight of the point they were making. The best I could take on it was that it was more of a sort of father substitute son relationship type film, which was not what I expected it was going to be. I'm a big fan of Paul Thomas Anderson, but despite popular opinion, this is not in the same league as Magnolia. Don't know whether you want to change it, but at your first music break, you inserted the audio for an Amazon trailer, so it played twice. Cheers, Morris. Yes, I fixed that. If people download the last episode again, I fixed that problem with duplicating the same track twice, which is something I'm prone to do, as our friend John in the Cayman Islands keeps pointing out. But this time around, I fixed it, and John pointed it out to me as well this time as well. But this time I fixed it, so if you go back and download it, it is now fixed. Yeah, I'm doing Newsfront for the radio gig. I'm doing with Liz Travascus in Darwin next Thursday, and then I'm also doing Newsfront the Thursday after. I haven't watched The Master yet, But I'm going to record the audio and attach it to the podcast when we do. I'm planning to watch it on Tuesday for recording on Thursday night. So I'll let you know what I think about The Master with Philip Seymour Hoffman, and we'll go from there. So other feedback, let me just scroll up here a little tiny bit. And that's the same one again, so I'll ignore that one. Yep, I did get something from John saying, "Hey Terry, it's John again in the Cayman Islands, so you know what that means. Yes, you have done it again. In Paleo Cinema 128, you played the trailer for Amazon Women on the Moon and then announced it had been Frenesy by the Four Freshmen. That was then followed by the trailer again. Sorry to be so picky, but you did say you appreciated my feedback. Yes, I do, John, and yes, I amended it when both you and Morris told me about it. Anyway, just so you don't think I'm just being negative, I made a suggestion for the subject matter of future podcasts. What about commemorating, certainly not celebrating, the 100th anniversary of the outbreak of the First World War by reviewing some movies about that conflict? You've already done Wings from 1927, although I mentioned it, but a few others spring to mind which might be worthy of your attention. How about All Quiet on the Western Front from 1930, for example? I've just re-watched it myself and thought it was very well made for its time. The picture quality of the version I picked up was excellent, although it was, in my opinion, marred somewhat by the lack of any attempt to neutralize the broad accents on the American actors who were supposed to be Germans, although the French actress spoke only in French. Also, it did suffer from the tendency of actors in the early days of sound to over-emote visually as well as being a bit wooden in their verbal presentation. Finally, and this is not the fault of the filmmakers, I was rather thrown by the fact that the hero's mother was a spitting image of Terry Jones in drag in a Monty Python sketch. I've got to confess, I haven't seen All Quiet on the Western Front. It's one of those ones where it's a big movie and it's one I should see. But I haven't seen it yet, but I will be seeing it. And yeah, the idea is good. Now, other films on this subject I've revisited, says John, in the last week, are Gallipoli, Close to Your Heart, No Doubt, and Oh, What a Lovely War, both of which, in their own unique way, have a powerful anti-war message to impart. I'm planning to also watch Hell's Angels from 1930 and Paths of Glory from 1957. I'm sure with your superior encyclopedic knowledge of movies, you could probably come up with many more movies of this ilk and fill out quite a few podcasts with them in the coming months or years. Anyway, Terry, that's my two penny worth for now. Cheers, John. Gallipoli, classic Australian film directed by Peter Weir, starring Mel Gibson and Mark, I'm trying to think of the guy's name, but anyway, had Bill Hunter in it as well. Yeah, that one's a sad one, and that war chewed up a lot of people. So it's on the list of things to do this year. I won't necessarily make it right for the anniversary of the start of World War One, but I'll do something this year with a couple of movies around and about World War One. Now, Paths of Glory is a good option. I've got a brand new spanking fresh Blu-ray of that, and I think that would be one of the films. But as far as the other one's concerned, Gallipoli's soundtrack puts me off a little bit, I'll be honest with you. It's a little bit 1980s, and it takes me out of the film a bit. But I'm going to do my homework. I'll do Paths of Glory, but I haven't worked out which of the second films I'll do yet. But yeah, thanks for that, John. That is definitely a good idea. And I like the theme for this podcast being Welsh actors. I think it's a great thing for the listeners to throw in their opinions, which I will dutifully either ignore or take on board wholeheartedly. There's no in-between on those things. But that's about it for this time around. Thank you very much for listening. I'll be back in 2 weeks with another Paleo Cinema podcast, and I don't know what it's going to be about. It may be, may not be about World War One, but one way or the other, I'll find something to throw at the internet on and around the subject of movies. I've actually had a 2-week break from doing the radio gig because apparently there's a cricket match in South Africa which takes up the time when Liz and I are normally talking about movies. But I'm back on schedule for this Thursday, so it's going to be The Master this Thursday, and the week after that we're doing Newsfront. I've got a couple of ideas for future movies as well, so we're going well on that one. And I'll be back next week with a Martian drive-in podcast, about which I know absolutely nothing at this stage, but it will be full of science fiction, fantasy and horror goodness. So anyway, in the meantime, look after yourselves, stay cool, stay sharp, don't fuck yourself around with alcohol and drugs, because that means there's less for me. And we'll get on with the rest of our lives until next time I talk at you. Take care.